On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
About 25 years ago, summer of 1992, my first summer in New York City, I found a job at the coffee shop on 16th Street in Manhattan, a restaurant slash bar with a club-like vibe that thinks quite highly of itself. The lights were always dim low and the waitstaff was plucked from various modeling agencies, and the place always felt like it was on the verge of breaking out into a full-blown discotheque at any second. That summer, the head maitre d' was called Paris. She was a tall, gorgeous trans woman who had once been on The Donahue Show. I was a little food runner on the overnight shift. Around 3 a.m., I'd be sucking on ketchup packets to stay awake. And on the dinner shift, there was this cool waiter named Maxwell.
I was a horrible waiter.
Everyone liked him, and no one really knew anything about him. Was Maxwell his real name? What was he into outside of the restaurant? No one knew. But everyone just liked the guy. He overflowed with charisma. Well, one night, he and I were going to the same party, and he asked me to cab with him as he ran by his place for a minute. So we get to his apartment on the Lower East Side, and it's tiny, barely enough room for a bed. But against the wall, there's racks of musical equipment. Maxwell tells me that he does music. Want to hear a song? Sure. He puts in a cassette, that's how long ago it was, and presses play. And I didn't really like it. But that's why I would have never made it in the music business. I'm a writer, journalist, TV host, and now a podcaster, welcoming you to the first episode of Torre Show, where I'll sit down with all sorts of successful Black people and talk about what made them successful. I want to know what's at the core of their triumphant career. I want to see what tactics and talents and attitudes helped fuel their rise. I want to know how they dealt with failure. We're going to talk to all sorts of people, singers, moguls, actors, rappers, athletes, poets, writers, poker stars, business stars, all sorts of people, to find those jewels that could help you as you rise to success. I'm thrilled to have my old friend Maxwell as my first guest. His 1996 debut album, Maxwell's Urban Hang Suite, blew up and established him as one of the leaders of the modern neo-soul movement. He's a superstar. We talked for a long time about how he keeps his head on straight.
I think they're screaming for the music. That's how I look at it. I think that's what's kind of kept my brain together. I think other people have an understanding about their success that way. That they're screaming for them, and that's cool. But for me, they're screaming for the music.
And why he takes years-long breaks between the albums.
What am I doing? Trying to forget who I'm supposed to be so I can become another version of the next person or the next phase of myself.
And what really fuels him?
What fuels you artistically more? Loving or breaking up?
Max is a really smart guy who's figured out a lot on his rise and yet stayed humble. And there's a lot of interesting gems in here that you can take with you as you climb the mountains in your life. Max and I met on a Saturday afternoon in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, in the cozy kitchen of the home of the famed photographer Mark Baptiste. We started by talking about what people who want to become singers should know.
If you're getting into it because you're trying to be famous, or there's any vanity, if any of the seven deadly sins are associated with why you're doing something, then there'll be an issue that you'll have to contend with in time. So if it's about servicing the world with something, filling in the gap, so to speak, that that exists within a certain sector of the community. I felt like, for me, you know, growing up, having the multicultural background that I have, you know, having to drown out some of the music, but subliminally it was going into my system. You know, having hip hop influences and old soul influences and even rock influences around me. And I think just the avant-garde-ness of just even being Caribbean makes you just do what you want. People don't necessarily think you're completely black, especially in the neighborhood I came from, even though I think anyone who has any kind of melanin should be or should consider themselves African-American on some level. So I just think that, that kind of wild card allowed me to have the freedom. And then, of course, my friends, you know, Hod being from Israel, Stuart being from Hull, England, there were no rules, you know. It was like we could do what we want.
Before you meet these folks, you are already a good vocalist, right? You know how to write a song, right? You know how to rock a keyboard.
It was all right, but...
Well, just with the vocals, how did you teach yourself to be a really good singer?
I mean, I still feel like I'm learning that. You know, it's a lesson that keeps, you know, unfolding. I think part of maybe being perceived as being good is to never know it and to always kind of still keep reaching for it. But, you know, I listen to people like Marvin Gaye, Anita Baker. Prince was a heavy influence because of his ability to arrange things in ways that I've never heard before. David Bowie, a lot of different influences kind of led to it, but I still didn't think I could do it. I just was super, super stubborn. I remember trying to set up my MIDI situation, which I'm sure musicians out there know and remember the time of Cynthia and MIDI. And I remember being so depressed because I couldn't get it to work. And I was depressed for 24 hours. I mean, I just threw my hands up and then went to sleep. And I just was like, I can't believe I can't put this together. And that's how I knew I cared. And that's pretty much when you know that you are onto something, is when it can frustrate you so much just in the process of trying to get it. But for just the execution part, not the result part, not the what's going to happen part, will I have a number one record part. No, you just want to execute. Like, you know, I'm sure when you're writing, it's probably the same thing. You just want to execute it. You know, whether you turn up on a lot of pages or people start talking about the story, that's great. That's fine. And that's an added plus. But just to be able to execute what you're trying to do was all I cared about. And that's all I still care about is execution.
The studio then is the fun part for you. Not, you keep saying like, I'm not about the fame. I'm about the studio and executing it. I love making the music.
Yeah, I love making the music. I can say that the pure joy for me is being done with the music and knowing it and performing it, because then it's done. But the actual constructing of the song and making sure that every note is right and that every word that's chosen, that can be laborious. It can be very arduous for me. And I feel like, am I making the right choice? Am I using the right? So it was actually a really good thing that when Urban Hangs Week came out, that it was shelved for a year. So I had a year with a finished record to really look at what it was and make the right decisions about sequencing as everybody else was done. And as the record label was figuring out where to fit me in, you know,
well, take me inside your music making process. How does it go? What do you do?
I mean, it can start in the shower. I mean, it can start with any conversation. You know, working with Hod, sometimes tracks, he comes up with some tracks, and you know, I may add things to the track, but songs happen fast. I mean, I don't like to listen to anything too long. It's just like, the last album, we had two cuts that I did with Stuart Matthewman. I never heard anything. They were all one take, never written down. I'm not trying to be the new Jay-Z out here. I'm just saying I found as I've grown older, that the first try is the best. It's God really speaking.
Really? First take, usually.
It can be like that simple. But, you know, you have to kind of find the words and the mumbled kind of melody moments, and then find the structure within some of the chord progressions so that it makes sense in terms of a production.
I mean, you're very much a feel person. Like, when it feels right, I'll do it, rather than I write from 10 to 12 or whatever.
Yeah, I'm a feel person. I mean, for me, if it's about going through stuff. I'm trying to, you know, change my process so it's not about coming from sorrow and pain, but that I can kind of be a happy person and still draw from experiences of disillusionment, experiences of disappointment, instead of having to be in constant situations where I'm disappointed so that I can then be of use creatively to the world. I don't want to have a complex to create. You know,
what? Wait,
does that make sense?
Yes, but let's talk about that. That historically, you have needed a complex to create. What do you mean?
I mean, just, you know, my life in itself. You know, just the idea of having to go out here and, you know, put myself in a position where I know that I'll be judged. I'll be judged, criticized, observed. It's very conditional to put yourself in this position. And then when you actually do something of substance, then you're judged based on the last great thing, and then onward and onward and onward, and it never stops. And it's all generational. So, you know, I remember being away for a long time on the scene and you know, just reading things about my relevancy and whether or not I would be relevant. And this was like in 2007. And then Pretty Wings comes out. And then everyone's cool with you, you know, and then now that's the bar that you have to sort of work from. Yeah. So it's, people don't really understand that. I mean, I don't work with like a big factory of songwriters. It's pretty much the same people. And then I step out and maybe I work with, you know, Alicia, who, you know, I knew it when she was 16, you know, and she was at Columbia. Alicia Keys, sorry for everyone who's out there who doesn't. I'm sure you guys know who she is. And then there's, of course, you know, working with R. Kelly, who, you know, I mean, he was such a huge movement in the 90s. I never got to meet him, even though I did a song, you know, with him sort of, you know. And that was actually not a bad thing because I had a little bit more control over the music and the way that Fortunate came together. Because he was busy, you know, writing other hits for
other people.
Yeah,
I mean, some of the anxiety that you talk about, you know, being judged by other people and sort of things, a lot of artists go through that. And for some folks, it's debilitating and they don't create, or they don't create to their potential. You get those feelings. Somehow you deal with it and you still get to your highest potential. So how do you combat those feelings and get to your greatest ability?
Well, I feel for me, you know, putting as much emphasis on the music as possible and de-emphasizing who I am. You know, obviously we're here to do an interview and find out all these details, but the more I can divorce myself from you being concerned about where I'm from, all the, like, who I'm, like, all that stuff that everyone wants to know, which has become a very prevalent part of promoting an artist now, where people are pretty much reality shows, which is fine. This is the social media era. You know, it's the era of, you know, knowing people's business. I mean, I remember a time where I didn't know what my greatest people that I didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
All I know is that album came, and, you know, there was a 2-year break or a 3-year or 4-year break, and we didn't know anything.
Right.
And all we had was those songs.
Right.
Now it's part of the promotion package is, you know, devising some scheme to create some sort of publicity stunt to get people interested into getting involved with you. And then, oh yeah, the music too. For me, I believe that, you know, when I look at someone like Sade, it's been, what, 7 years since she put out Soldier of Love. We don't know nothing.
Nothing.
And that's a special thing. I hope we can go back to a place where we could just leave people alone and let them be creative people instead of trying to get interested in them to then dissect them, destroy them, and then move on.
So sort of, it's not hiding, but de-emphasizing the you allows you to get to allows you to put aside the anxiety to get to, okay, now let's create.
Right. And then also it allows the listener to actually apply themselves to the songs more. Because I find that a lot of the stuff that I hear, and it's fine because I love everything on a broad spectrum in terms of music and art, and it's all about the artist's position and what they're trying to convey. But I love the mystery of certain artists. You know, I love, I mean, of course you want to know stuff, but there's so much about Prince that we just never knew.
Yeah.
And thus it gave his music so much weight that it wouldn't have had if we would have known what toilet paper he uses or like, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And in this day and age, I think people are pretty super nosy for no reason.
Yeah.
And there's this great expectation to feel like they have the right to be in your business.
And
for whatever reason, I don't quite understand, but it is what it is.
I mean, a lot of people make music that lets us see, you know, a wide range of them. Here's me happy. Here's me sad. I mean, here's me wilding out, whatever. And you talk about catering to the grandest part of yourself. And it seems it's very aspirational. It's about love and romance and sort of, you know, Maxwell at his greatest moments. And you too can come here and be with me.
And sometimes, right? Not so great moments. Moments of, you know, regret. You know, Pretty Wings is a regretful song. It's a song of messing up and, you know, admitting to a certain aspect of my role in how I can sabotage relationships. You know, lost as well. And, you know, so there, I'm not really always painting with rose colored, you know, glasses, but I can say that, you know, I just want the music to be the most important part of it.
And we see that in, like, you know, a lot of times your picture is not on the cover of the album. Right. I mean,
hiding my face.
Right. Right. And which is part of that, like, it's not a fame gesture. It's not about me. It's about this music. Right. And if people have that focus, then they can get to their best musical selves.
Right. I think they can. I mean, it's all a question of, you know, it just depends on how you're structured in terms of what you're trying to convey as an artist. Some people are really awesome at being famous. I have a few of my friends. I mean, they're just great at it. They're ready for those paparazzi. They got the looks ready. They got the whole week ready for every step they take. I don't like to think about it so much. Sometimes I like to just, you know, go out there, book a tour, you know, focus on connecting with people in the room, because it's real to me. The internet's not real to me. You can buy followers. You can buy, you know, you can create an impression, a digital impression of yourself.
Sure.
That can be disputed, but you can't dispute a packed house at Madison Square Garden with real people, you know, from all walks of life. It's indisputable.
This is part of what you have achieved and continue to achieve that I think astounds a lot of other people, that you are popular without ever going pop, right? And I know this is a constant challenge. How do you maintain that? Because it's like walking on a tightrope, right? To be popular without going pop. How do you do that?
I have no idea. I honestly.
But you're thinking about it, right?
I think about it. And I think also it's just not giving people what they quite expect, pushing the boundary a little bit, you know, like Urban Hanks, we came out, and then we did the Unplugged, which was, you know, what's this woman's work song, written by Kate Bush, English woman, white English woman from, you know, what is this song? Yeah, I remember this song, and she's having a baby. Everyone got to, you know, to do a cover. That's just basically how Unplugged did it. And I'm like, okay, well, you just have to choose a cover, whatever it is. Of course, I got suggestions to do Al Green, Marvin Gaye, and I was like, you know, I think Kate Bush might be a good one. They're like, what? And I'm saying, well, there's a song about a woman supposed to be singing. It's about a woman. I'm like, well, this could be cool because there's already a disparity between men and women, and in Mars versus Venus, and whether men understand women. I think this might be fresh if a guy sings it, because it might build a bridge. And so, you know, we're trying to work the arrangement out and figure out how to put it together. So, you know, her arrangement was very a certain way. And I was like, but we need to make it really, you know, soulful, because I kind of want to hear it on WBLS.
Right.
It might be nice.
Right.
So somehow with the help of Andre and so many people who were in the band, we worked it out. And I remember Paul Schaefer coming in, because we were going over and over and over it. And very difficult song to sing, I have to tell you. It's like probably the hardest song, but because, you know, she's high up there. So Paul Schaefer comes out of nowhere, and he's just peeking through the door. And I was like, I think this is going to work. Because, you know, Paul Schaefer was, you know.
The man.
He was the man. I mean, for, people won't know now, but I'm sure.
Late Show.
Yeah, the Late Show.
David Letterman.
David Letterman.
But, you know, part of so much of your success is because people love your voice, right? And you get that beautiful falsetto, which is just so precise and just cuts through the track. And no matter what's going on, your voice is going to stand out. And you talk about Woman's Work being one of the hardest songs that you have sung, and it's one of your signature songs at this point. Talk about the challenge of singing that. And, you know, I mean, you're like an athlete, but you're singing rather than running and jumping and throwing. Right. So just from an athletic, physical standpoint, how is it hard? How do you meet the challenge of singing that particular difficult song?
Well, no talking. You know, no vices. controlling no
smoking,
exactly.
Alcohol.
No alcohol. No herbal delights. You know, however you want to put it.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a lot of discipline. It's great when I get into about a week or so in the tour. If I have like a 5-week tour, I'm good, because then I understand what I need to do. The sound works the way it needs to work. But, you know, it's a delicate thing in terms of weather. You know, when I was on the road with Mary, you know, I learned Mary J. Blige. I learned a lot about warming up. But there is a part of me that wants to surrender myself from the obligation of my voice sometimes. Maybe I rebel by not putting in the kind of effort that I need to, you know, because before, when I was in the beginning, it was no big deal. You know, just, you know, you're fresh and life hasn't hit you as long as it's been hitting you. So now there's a lot of discipline that I have to apply that I didn't really know that I needed, that I didn't necessarily need to apply before.
The discipline in terms of what you're not putting in your throat, in terms of warming up, in terms
of just the rest aspect, the water aspect. I don't drink anymore. I mean, there's so many things that have had to go. You know, and
like
I didn't
what?
Drink when I was 30. I mean, I was like, while everyone was getting out of their minds in their 20s, when people saw me in 96, I never knew what even being drunk was. I didn't even know. I mean, I remember people around us, and, you know, obviously we have mutual friends. They'd be out and they'd be having a great time, and I had no clue what any of that was until I was 30, until I'd already secured, I guess, a foundation of sorts. And now it's weird. It's like, full circle going back and being that same person again, with no need, because it's like, is it something that I understand already too much?
Well, let's stay on this, though, you know, because you talked a lot with me about doing a great live show. Yeah. And that's super important. You know, you have a great touring career. What are the keys to putting on a great live show?
Well, you know, it's changed. Initially, there were no screens. It was good lighting. And depending on the venue, if you're a club, if you're in a theater, great. Fast forward to 2014, 15, the world of screens. I recently decided to go away from screens because I think that they're distracting. It's a hell of a lot of money to put them together. And I think with the musicality of what we have already in terms of the catalog, that we could still make it work. People don't necessarily need to see you behind you, you know, to really get a sense. I know there are people in the back that really want to get it, but, you know, I think there's something that it takes away from just being able to just absorb the music. So, you know, I'm transitioning from doing that. And it's, I feel like it's good, you know, because I feel like it takes you back to the old school a little bit.
What do you, but what do you need to do?
What do I need to do?
Yeah, to do a great live show in terms of vocally, in terms of movement, in terms of relation to the audience. What makes a great live show?
I mean, for me, it's nice. I remember doing Constitution Hall. I like being in the same place for a long, for consecutive amount of days because it's almost like you're in a resident. It's like a residency. And I think that when you're comfortable in the space, as opposed to going to one arena, to another arena, to another arena, in different places, different situation, different acoustics. I was talking to, you know, this guy who does, you know, soccer, football, Manchester guy. And he was talking about how he deals with his athletes and that everything that they do is about recovery. So as soon as the athlete leaves the field, that's when they really kick in. So the bed's the same, the room temperature's the same. And so for people who are interested in doing music or who are interested in performing on any level, it's about recovery time. It's difficult to do that after you're so gassed up from being in front of so many people. And if it's a great show, then you're wired. And then, you know, you want to, you know, have a drink, you want to chill, you
party,
whatever. And this is what I learned from Mary J, is she'd be like, Max, I just shut it down. You know, I just shut down. Like, no talking. I'm in the room. And I learned a lot from her, you know, especially that tour, because it was real, you know, 33 shows all around the world. Oslo, Norway, Zurich, you know, London, O2. And, you know, it's amazing. She's something to behold.
What is the feeling of, you know, you're in whatever city, 20, 30, 40,000 people screaming for you?
I think they're screaming for the music. That's how I look at it.
So you don't want the ego blast of they're screaming for me?
I don't feel like that. I don't. I think that's what's kind of kept my brain together. I think other people have an understanding about their success that way, that they're screaming for them, and that's cool. But for me, they're screaming for the music. And, you know, when we do documentaries about the shows, I'm always very, very vigilant about focusing in on the band, their lives, mm-hmm. and how as a team we create this experience. You know, my organist, the guy who plays B3, his name is Shedrick Mitchell. And, you know, I go to that church that we just photographed. I'm not going to say what it is because I kind of want to go there and right. not have it be a moment. You know, I go up in the balcony and I just had my moment. I'm not religious. Obviously, I'm Christian by nurture, much more spiritual because I am inclusive of other belief systems. But I feel like it's nice for the spirit on a meditative level to go somewhere and just, you know, commune with people who actually are connecting for something that raises the vibration in your spirit. So that's kind of why I like church. And that's something that I feel like my grandmother gave me, the first Bible she ever gave me, the second one, which I still have. But I'm not restricted by the details of scripture specifically.
In one of the docs, you talk about not wanting to rehearse too much because that drowns out the spontaneity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk about that a little. That's interesting.
I mean, I feel like the audience adds. I feel like the audience adds an incredible element to the show that I won't understand in rehearsal. So, and then of course, banter, how you deal. Like, it's different when you're in it, when you're doing a show in Chicago than when you're doing a show in Paris. Like, what you're going to say in Paris is very different than what you'll say when you're home. So the banter and the, you know, a certain amount of freestyling comes into play. So it's always good to start in Europe because you kind of work the kinks out. I'm sure you've heard this before, right? Because they're very forgiving over there of mistakes and what have you. And then you get to, you know, you get to the States and it's a different thing. You know, it's interesting for me because I go through the Carolinas and I mean, I'm quote unquote, not a person that was, and I've heard this from, interestingly, from people, you know, traditional black, you know, whatever that's supposed to mean. And to see the music affect people. I'm from Brooklyn. You know, mom's from Haiti, dad's from Puerto Rico. I grew up with hip hop. I grew up, you know, reading James Baldwin. And then just two blocks over, all kinds of crime was going on. So there was always choices. And it was A Divided Soul, you know, one of my favorite books, Marvin Gaye.
David Wright.
And I think basically, like, that's the core of it all is as people of color, there are choices. There's a choice to go here and there's a choice to go there. But you'll always be tested by Satan, whatever you think is the devil in your life. And, you know, fame is very interesting, though, because it does bring out the seven deadly sins. You know, I could tell you, you know, you have to have a few humbling moments where it doesn't come together for you the way you thought so that you can get back to the center of why you do things. And I've had a few of those even before I had a record out, you know, where I had to play in front of five people at a club and do a full set with vigor and conviction.
For five people.
Five people. But, didn't pay or anything.
This is a bigger challenge for folks like you. When you did the first album, you built on the experiences over your entire life up to that moment.
Speak the truth.
Second
bro.
Album, you built on the experiences of the year and change between
a fame.
The previous album.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, your interaction with the world is different right. when you are famous than when you are coming up and trying to become. So how do you maintain whatever you need to maintain to get back to the energy, the perspective that you had when you weren't famous and you made that record that everyone loved?
Well, I mean, you know, you have to be willing to risk. Well, you have to be lucky enough to have people invest or have belief.
Well, I think what we're talking about is the challenge of creating when you're a star versus when you're not. Right. And there was sort of was it not easier before you were a star? How do you maintain the connection to that real human experience so you can create relatable music?
I had no concept of whether or not everything was working. In the midst of it working, I didn't know. I didn't feel like that at the company. I didn't feel like that on the road, even with the first set of club shows. What was happening in the world didn't affect me until, I think it was maybe the summer of 1996. I remember walking outside and just thinking, well, what's going on? Like, do I have something on my face? Like, is there something wrong going on here? And then that's when I realized, like, oh, something has happened where people are aware of that. And then from that point on, you know, you're just shuttled off to situations where you're working through the process of the stardom. So I had no awareness of it. It's not like I came back to the record company and they made me feel like that, you know. I never, ever felt comfortable about the process because I felt like it could easily be taken away. Mm. Would I be a one-hit wonder? There were so many people popping up out of nowhere, which is what tends to happen when something becomes a bit of a phenomenon. You know, we're 4 or 5 Radio City Music Hall shows. 4 or 5 Radio Music City Hall shows, first album. You know, labels catching up with the interest of the people. Like, not really, you know what I mean? That people were really trying to catch up with what was happening. It wasn't like the strategic, planned, understood, like, this is going to work. You know, I had a lot of people, I wouldn't say, you know, just people who had the same goals as artists and their teams, having a very, how would you say, a singular understanding about how success can work for the African-American man. It was only one black man can have this crown, and we're going to take, that person has to be taken down because this one has to be the one. And, you know, and watching the infighting between various artists as they come up, or those who were before, and the strange competitiveness that you would start to experience from people you actually were looking up to.
One thing that's different about you than everybody else, you make albums.
When they used to be,
right? It used albums. To be an album is a cohesive musical statement. All the songs fit together.
Right.
Most of what we get today are disparate, 12 or 15 disparate ideas made by different producers with different guests, and the songs don't really have anything to do with each other, except there happens to be a vocalist who,
it's all algorithm based now.
What does that mean?
Algorithms in terms of how the internet works, who is featured, who the producer is. It's all based on this algorithmite thing.
So you mean like A&Rs are telling you, well, you know.
Well, no. So I wouldn't say A&Rs because I haven't had one, a real one, in 10 years. But I will say that what happens is, because of the new digital age, things are suggested to you based on the song, the producer, the feature. So if you like this song, then you'll like that song.
Right.
And then that's what's happened now. So that's why a lot of people partner up with DJs, because it just sort of gives them a broader reach. And it's a little, it's difficult for me because I still work with the same team. And I always get requests to work with people, and here and there I do, but I make creative decisions because I like the person, not because it's going to give me a bigger audience.
Yeah.
People look at me and they scratch their heads. It's like, this is a no brainer. You'll be number one, but that's not how I like to approach music.
But creating albums.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective, and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Back in 2018, Trump's Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported the parents back to their home countries while keeping the kids in the United States, separating and destroying hundreds of families. It was heartbreaking. And years later, hundreds of families still have not been reunified. I recently learned about an organization that's trying to make a difference. It's El Atrolado, and it works to reunify families, providing holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in America and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. They've reunified over 100 refugee families ripped apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Once they're reunited, they help each family find legal representation, housing, counseling, whatever they need to get on their feet. Imagine having your child ripped from your arms just because you went to another country seeking a better life, and you never know when or if you'll ever see them again, and not ever seeing them again. We can't let family separations go on. It's inhumane. And if you're like me, and you believe that families belong together and immigration should not separate them, then join me in supporting El Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to El Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gun.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved: fill out an application at their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer. El Otro Lado, ELOTROLADO.org/volunteer.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
And like, how and why are you doing that when most people have left that idea alone?
I'm old. I don't know. I mean, just to keep it real, it's just there's no other way to think about it. I feel like that's going to come back eventually again. I mean, there's a huge movement with vinyl that I think that people are underestimating right now amongst the Gen Z group. There's a huge movement of, you know, just wanting that analog experience again. You know, even with Solange's album, when you listen to the way that she made it and how she did it, it feels like a 90s thing to me. You know, and she also gives dap. Like, when I was coming into the game or the business, I try to not look at it that way, but, you know, I had no problem saying Prince is the reason, you know what I mean? And Marvin Gaye, and, you know, getting Leon Ware to help me co-write Something Something, having Wawa Watson on first of my three albums. No problem looking back and saying, this is the reason why I make music. I have a tendency to look at people now, and a lot of them really think that we're not aware of how obvious it is that they've had certain influences. It's almost like they don't want to admit to the obvious influence that you can clearly see, because everyone feels like they want to feel like they're everyone's memory is so short. Yeah. And especially in this day and age, with one, you know, huge blow up about this, and then in 24 hours we're on to the next one, and then we're on to the next one. By the time we're through 10 of them, we've forgotten the first, and then we just move on, right?
Tell me about it.
So, you know, I just like that, you know, when you see someone like Solange get up there and she's receiving an award, she's thanking Erykah Badu, you know, she's thanking, you know, the 90s pioneers, and has no problem doing it. And I find that a lot of people don't really do that, especially in misappropriation of music in terms of the culture. You know, I feel like, you know, especially at the Grammys, you know, I did my voting thing, and, you know, but it's strange when a Solange, you know, isn't able to receive her award on television. Mm. And most of the people, like Michael Jackson during Off the Wall, didn't receive his award on television. But a lot of the music that ends up being at the top tier of the telecast is influenced or written by people from the culture.
Yes.
So, and that's been going on forever.
But you know, you talk about staying true to those old school ideals in you. And when you have an industry suggesting, pushing, pressuring you to take some of the new things, the algorithm, the features, what have you, how do you say no in a way that allows you to do your thing, you know? And because it can be hard to say no to the machine.
Absolutely.
You know, especially when it is having success for other people. How do you do that to maintain, I'm going to stay in my lane and not change? Because your lane is quite unique, right? There's not too many people who are doing what you do, the way you do it.
You know, it's a feeling thing. It's not personal. It's also sometimes procrastination. I mean, there's times when I have so many features that have happened that I've tried to do that didn't end up making it, didn't end up, you know, coming together.
So you've said yes sometimes.
Yeah, for sure.
And then it just didn't work.
Yeah, it just didn't work. Sometimes you try out a few features and then one happens. Depending on circumstances, 20 minutes with Fire We Make in the studio, out, done, great. But I have chemistry. I know Alicia. I know her husband, like the family.
Swiss Beats.
Yes, Mr. Swiss Beats. Harvard, about to be Harvard guy. Well, he is a Harvard guy now. But yeah, no. So, you know, there's like natural connections that way. I'm not the guy that's into the, you know, cherry picking, like, you know, Svengali, like, yeah, this will work because blah, blah. I actually know the people that I kind of work with. Mm. I like to understand them, have history with them. I had no concept of how hip hop was affected by what I did. I want to thank you for including me in a very historical moment that, you know, meant so much to me. I remember shooting the cover or doing a photo shoot with Miss Hill, right?
Lauryn Hill.
And this was just after the score had become this huge hit, you know, winning everything. And we're shooting for the cover as a group. It was me and her on the cover. And of course we lost Biggie. And when they decided to go with that cover, you featured a quote by Biggie himself about me. And that was very important to me because, you know, while Hot 97 was the holy grail, even though WBLS was the reason why everything happened, and people who gravitated to my music were 10 years older than me, even 20 years older than me. And then there were college students, of course. But to hear from a Brooklyn native that everyone bowed to, there was no, there was, for Brooklyn, there was Biggie and then there was Jay-Z. And, you know, everyone was obviously Biggie, 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 you know? But I remember buying Reasonable Doubt and just going, I mean, I love Biggie, but this Reasonable Doubt situation. And I remember seeing Jay-Z long ago and being like, yo, this album's great. Yeah. You know, this album's really good. And I wasn't even released. It was like 95, right? Reasonable Doubt came out in 95. Right, 95, 96. Maybe even the same year. But I remember listening to that album consistently, all the while loving Biggie. Because, you know, he had Junior Mafia and he was doing all the work with Lil' Kim and everybody. And to be included in that piece, knowing that it'd been, you know, this has happened a couple times. It's very weird where you're about to experience great success and then a great tragedy occurs. And then it's, you know, so it was really interesting for me. And then to know that you did the interview, and it was like really special because, like, I think we marked the 10-year anniversary or the 15 or something, 20-year anniversary. And somebody actually posted on Instagram your quote or your article and the quote that included him saying, hey, you know, Max is good. And it was to get, to get love from him when someone like who I am wasn't the what you expect it to be considered and respected within the community and within the culture, a culture of, you know, great machismo, great, you know, like that.
Yeah.
And then to my whole thing is silk, lace, oil,
love, romance,
incense.
Yes.
You know, like my whole thing was that.
Suited and booted.
Suited and booted, you know. And I remember people just going, this is how it's going to be marketed, really? And no one really even knew because, you know, I had always had my crazy thing, like I braids and turban, whatever, you know. And then I think a couple of girls like Michaela Angela Davis, yes, who we know very well now, yes, she was like, let's get that hair out, you know. And no one had seen any of it, so it wasn't this plan.
But she
thing.
Told you to let it fly.
Yeah, no,
to be it like was a big like, afro.
It was like her and Eric and a couple other people were like,
Eric
yo,
Coles.
Okay. No, actually, Eric Johnson.
Okay.
Eric Johnson, the photographer.
Okay.
Eric Coles plays a pivotal role in a publishing aspect of right. my career because right. he was working at Rondor at the time. Now right. he's somewhere else. I think he's Ralph Lauren. Or, you know, he's moved. He's always going to be good, that right. guy. But, you know, it was all of it just, there was no plan. It was almost like, I was on a ride. I had no idea what was going to happen. And I feel like I'm still on the same ride. And that's why when you ask me if people are screaming for me, they're screaming for a
music.
Movement, I think.
This is something you keep coming back to in lots of different ways, that you don't allow this to become an ego gesture. You don't allow this to become feeding Maxwell's ego. And I think that's critical to who you are and how you're able to present yourself, right? And you're sort of very consciously saying, they're not screaming for me, they're screaming for the music. You know, don't put my face blow up, you know, focus on the music. Mm-hmm. You keep mentioning that in lots of different ways.
I feel like, especially in 22, 21 years later, it's a nostalgia, it's an experience, it's cookouts, it's Sunday night, it's, you know, 20 years of film, you know, obviously, the 90s are back a bit. There's a great window of opportunity to, you know, break through in a different way creatively. And we're clearly working on that process right now. But I feel like it's more like a cultural thing that they're about.
But you also talk a lot about...
And me.
You talk a lot about fear and anxiety shaping what you do.
Yeah. Yeah, just can't, you know, let them see you sweat. I mean, even if you
What are you anxious about?
Failure of, you know, not meeting up to the challenge, not living up to the promise. Not being as much of what I'm supposed to live up to, especially when you see it accelerate before your eyes, and then all of a sudden you have to catch up with this thing that you, oh shit, you know, damn, here it is, it's happening, and now I gotta live up to this thing, and I gotta sound as better than the records, and I gotta be better than the records, and then you grapple with also, you know, issues of the conditional aspect of your career. What are people really interested in when it comes to you? Is it how you look? The fact that you do what you do? Is it how you sound? Or is it who you are? Is it the persona? Or is it the person? So you struggle with that. You struggle with that conditional aspect of love. And then you're talking about love at the same time. So it's like... you know, what do they really want, you know? And, you know, and then, you know, you have all these insane opportunities relationship-wise, and obviously you go out of your way to not make that get in the way. I mean, there's been some very that situations, you know, and it could have been like power couple type shit, you know? Like, yo, this is like, boom, boom, boom. And I've seen that happening, and some of them are organic. And clearly, you know, the ones that are, and then there are the ones that are very strategic, and they're based on the business of being more successful and being more famous. and as a person who looks at life a certain way and wants an authenticity with regards to relationship emotion, because that's where I draw my power from, make the work. It can't be about how it looks to the world, or how it will be experienced. So, you know, being, you know, a guy who was very interested in like the blackest girl in the room, you know, and then being in a situation where that gets challenged, because, you know, God is always challenging your idea of what love is. So then all of a sudden, maybe this blonde blue-eyed girl is sparking a flame. But what am I going to do if I like a white girl? How will it be received? What if I do? What am I going to do? You know, is my career going to be over? Do I actually have to date based on my demographic and based on the people who buy my music? Wait a minute. So now everything is flipping, because I actually have to be a politician to the music that's basically supposed to be a fantasy for anyone's life. So I feel like a lot of people struggle in the industry with that issue.
I mean, it would definitely be hurtful to a lot of your fans to see, like, here's yet another good-looking, successful black man who's with a white woman, right? And a lot of your grown black female fans would be like, you know, here we... And, you know, I think they are respectful of love when they see one or two examples, but, you know, they're like, wow, we've seen 100 examples of this. Why do our brothers keep leaving? Right? So, and you're...
And what about the flip side, too, when you think about it?
Well, I mean, I don't... I don't feel like the brothers are getting so upset because we don't feel like... We don't feel a woman shortage. We don't talk about that. They talk about a man shortage. And when they see brothers going outside, you know what I mean? I think your particular fans feel that. So when you, you know, when you're at home trying to choose who to love...
And you love is choosing you.
And love is choosing, and you
got that. Destiny has no color and understanding. Fate is fate. And if you believe in past lives, then shit, you know? Of course. I mean, I believe that there's certain people that you meet in your life that resonate in a way that make you feel like you've known them before. Whatever that adds up to in terms of your pathology and your ideology of what the situation is, it could be just good chemistry. But some people, you know, factor it in a different way and say, hey, you know, this feels like kismet to me. It's interesting, you know, this is probably the most pivotal part of this conversation for me, because I feel like people are restricted based on your career and like how it plays itself out and who your fans end up being. Sometimes you're an African-American performer and all your fans aren't black, you know? You know what I mean? What do you do then?
Sure.
And that's a scary position, because if your own people ain't down, you know.
I want to go back just a little bit, because D'Angelo and I have talked about this a lot, about, you know, do they like me, or do they in the look, or do they like the music, you know? And especially when he was doing Voodoo and the body was, you know, like at the zenith. And he's like, you know, and he's doing these amazing songs and they're screaming, take your shirt off. And he's going, this is about the music for me. It's not about the washboard abs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wonder about you and not him, but he was dealing with the same sort of dichotomy that you're talking about. Like, can we talk about the music and not the look?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's part of the process. I mean, I think... In the end, you just got to go with what works. You got to go with what works for you and what makes you happy. And I think at the same time, you welcome a certain amount of invasion, the way that you portray your career, the way that you are about the way you deal with things with press. It just depends on how you approach it. Because I feel like people who ask for it get it. Do you know what I mean?
I do. You said something interesting about that you like to play like you're losing.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting way of looking at it. And, you know, yeah, we all who play sports or played sports, we know, like, if you start like, I'm winning, then you relax, right? I'm going to, if you're like, I'm going to win this game, you relax. And then the loss can come. What does that mean in terms of being a recording artist, being a star? What does play like you're losing really mean?
I mean, for me, it's, you know, being a Knicks fan. being a Knicks fan, you know, just being from Brooklyn, just even, you know, being clearly aware of the disenfranchised, marginalized experience that we have as, you know, people of color. You know, I never ever feel, you know, I'm always on a chair with one leg missing, you know. So I'm always at this place where, you know, I got to keep my balance because it's not stable. But on the same token, that's what spurs on the drive that keeps you moving. So, and you don't get complacent about who you're supposed to be all the time. You can cut your hair. You can get older. You can change how you approach your visual thing. You can progress. You can evolve. What I tend to see a lot in big pop stars is this holding on to the past, having to have that look, keep that body, be able to move that way, but not really sort of grow into this arc. Like when you look at someone like a Nina Simone or, you know, Aretha Franklin, Sade, there's just, you know, it's this graceful elegance that just keeps getting better with time. And it's just how you approach that in your career. I mean, people don't realize that, and, you know, I want to close with this because this is about giving people a window about what they need to do to get in. You must have your philosophy on point. Philosophically and spiritually, what are you trying to leave behind? If any of the seven deadly sins have any association with it, then you will have challenges that the universe will bring to you to get you to progress past that,
so,
I feel.
So what is your philosophy then?
Legacy, tradition, remembering your forefathers, you know, imbuing and embodying some of their ideals, Harry Belafonte, even Hector Lavoe. Like, you know, you're young and foolish, and that's fine. People give you, they give you carte blanche on that. And you get to be in your 20s. You don't really know so much. You know, you just want, you know, be, as we say, and rich, you know, flash, get your cash, have the girls, whatever you want to be about. But then at a certain point in your career, you have to say to yourself, am I an echo of something that has fortified the situation from the past, or am I an echo of something that's disintegrating and destroying what we are as people? And that's
we live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon, a mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
The challenge that I think more hip-hop people deal with, you know, and because of just how quick it is with hip hop. And that's why you look at someone like Jay-Z and you have to give him credit. And you have to look at Nas and you have to give him credit, because as much as they were talking about the knucklehead stuff, they would imbue certain songs, certain things like, I know I can't be what I want to be, you know. I mean, that was major for Nas to do that, to include kids in his chorus.
No, that was beautiful. You were on the Sade path. Right, like
I guess. I hope I'm not off. I hope I'm not off of it.
Take a long break. Put out an album. Take a long break.
Yeah, lose. Yeah.
Why the long breaks? And what are you doing?
What am I doing? Trying to forget who I'm supposed to be, so I can become another version of the next person or the next phase of myself. And also just, you know, after a couple of years of performing in front of so many people, you are done with people. I mean, you love them, but that's, I've seen a lot of people. People are like, well, why don't we go out? And I'm like, well, I'm good for about a week or two just watching television. You know what I mean? Because I'm not chasing or worried about the person coming behind me. I'm kind of like on the racetrack, focused, trying to find ideas. I mean, I've got new interests that have sparked recently, working with Sankofa, working with Artists for Peace and Justice, APJ, working with Brilliantly Beautiful, working with, I mean, philanthropy has become my new passion, charities, you know, how I can actually benefit, you know, the people that listen to what I do, how I can use my voice, not in a overzealous way where it's like, oh God, like he's too, you know, goody two shoe guy all of a sudden, but just like, yo, you know, it's a responsible thing. What are my ideals and how I can actually, you know, reflect those out there into the universe and bring opportunity to people.
When you talk about these periods off and you're recharging the battery.
I'll wild out. I'll be wilding out too. I mean,
having fun.
I like to have a moment where I don't have to think about a vocal schedule or a this, you know, it's quite rigorous. I don't want to complain about it because it's champagne problems to the person listening. But, you know, I need time to just not be concerned about how I appear or how I'm looking all the time sometimes.
Right. Right.
And that can be sometimes a bit too long. But, you know, I'm always blessed with the great reception of this concern from the community to come back.
They want you to come back.
It's so beautiful,
they keep saying, we need you.
And I want to thank everyone for the encouragement and the reminder of, because I forget who I'm, I guess I forget what it all means to you. Yeah. And then to, you know, you think, well, okay, all these, this new wave of artists have come, I'm done. And then they're like, wait. No, we actually really want you to come back. And you're like, wow, okay.
What what fuels you artistically more, loving or breaking up?
I think loving now. Loving. And I'm at that place where loving. I've had enough of the breaking up part. I got that down. I understand it. I understand rejection. I understand what it feels like to, you know, have, you know, my overtures go, you know, unnoticed. And then at the same time, I'm very suspicious of even interest that comes my way because I'm not certain what it is. Is it charity? Is it strategic? You know, I battle with my own insecurities about my self-worth. People don't realize that, but I do wonder sometimes if I'm good enough for certain situations. I mean, it's a big struggle for me where I feel like, you know, this person is just too good for me. So I may have sabotage it or get wrapped up in, you know, the cause of what I need to, you know, finish in terms of my career. I know that people are going to be like, really, this is bullshit. But no, it's something that I've discussed with past girlfriends of mine. And I just, they mean, I know their husbands, you know what I mean? Like I meet their kids and I'm like, I just want you to know that I just didn't think that I was good enough for you. And they're like, you know, and they, it's weird, but it's true where you feel like.
You've sublimated your ego so much. So as I can see, you know, 1,000 women be like, he was not enough for someone, but like, there's so much of who you are. Okay, look. We always talk about on the show failure and how folks get through failure. Hmm. Talk about an instructive failure that you went through. There was a something, you know, you fell down and how you rebounded and how you learned and grew and were stronger after that happened.
This probably goes way back to it's a more family based feeling, and it echoes throughout my entire career, and with being, you know, respectful of my upbringing and the people who were my elders, it's a very difficult topic for me to ever express because I don't ever want to call people out, but there's certain aspects to how I was raised and how I was nurtured that made me extremely stubborn about making a mark to the world where I couldn't have made it to a certain guardian. I'll just say that. So the failure of being aware of how insignificant my presence in life was then made me pretty aggressive about making an impact to the world.
You feel like I have something to prove.
Yeah, I had a chip on my shoulder.
Your childhood did not give you that sense of confidence. It gave you something to fight back against and to overcome.
Yeah, and it's funny because I was watching, you know, an autobiography of so many. I mean, I've read so many stories, and it's like, wow, this is kind of like a thread that I see in so many different careers. It's this lack of acceptance in terms of just career choice, what you want to do, what the stipulations that your family put on you in terms of what your career should be, and, you know, them knowing better. And then, of course, us being, I think a lot of us being West Indians, first generation, second generation, that West Indian culture of, you know, you're going to grow up, you're going to be an attorney, and you're going to be a doctor, and you're going to, like, have a pension, and you're going to support the family and continue. And then when you're a person that is creative and you're, like, trying to explain to your parents that you really like music or you like photography or you like to paint or you like to write, they're like, that's not real money. We need real money. So you're like, you have to like work within the context of, especially for me, when I went to Haiti, when I went there and saw what it was like, instant forgiveness for me. It was like, oh, I get it.
But
I get it now.
But you felt unloved.
Wouldn't say that. I felt that Caribbean love is different. It's love, because Caribbean love is very forgiving because of how difficult it is for specific areas, depending on where you're from in the Caribbean. We all have a different experience, but when you're migrating, or when people know a life that you didn't know because you grew up here, and then you tell them you want to make music, and they're looking at you like, we know people who make music back where we're at, and they're on the corner making music and nothing's happening. They don't quite get that you're in this new culture where there's an opportunity that could actually really launch you in a different way. And so when you're dealing with that at the same time, it's like you're not living up to a standard, then all of a sudden you're actually succeeding out in the world. And then there's, it's just tough for people who are raising you to admit when they're wrong.
So basically. So how did the challenges, the screwed upness that you're referencing, how did that fuel the artist you become?
I think, I think forgiveness is key to really get to the pinnacle of it all. At some point, the chip on your shoulder, you kind of got to let it go, because it doesn't really allow you to fortify really.
But early on, the chip propels you.
The chip propels you. It does get you out there. I mean, there's no other choice. There's no plan B. And people can feel the urgency of your interest, you know, like you really, really care about what you're trying to do. You're not really trying to be famous. This is not about like looking good. You kind of really are super anti-fame, but pro art. And then, you know, you have wonderful people like Mark Baptiste shot me 22 years ago and did like our version of Elvis. You know, because I loved Elvis, and I thought Elvis always did the illest photos, and he had like the red shirt, red background. And it's something that only in hindsight that I look back on and I go, wow, you know, everyone was going through what I was going through. Every artist that I was connected with had the same experience.
Difficult childhood, you mean?
I don't want to say difficult childhood, but I will say that to walk into a room and to tell your parents who want you to actually go to college and get what they consider to be a degree of merit, right? After they've migrated here and they're looking to you for the hope of their security. I mean, that burden alone for a kid, I don't think they really can think about how much of a how hard that is for just for kid to feel. Like at 10, you feel this. Yeah. Like you better go to school, you go to college, and you become a doctor. And this is before you even got into first grade. You already know that. And I know a lot of people feel that. And a lot of kids naturally feel that. Maybe not the millennials, because it's millennials different. Millennials have a feeling that.
The last thing, though.
Sure.
So the moment that you were able to go home and say, look, I became a singer, and look at this big check, or look at this, now I can help you out. Now I can do those things financially that you thought I wouldn't be able to do on the music road. And what did that feel like?
You know, it's not as satisfying as you think, because even though you can bring this money in, all of a sudden, it's weird. It's like you were lucky. And then you're like, you were just lucky for 20 years. And it happens with friends, too. I'm sure you know this, too. You know, when you burst on the scene and all of a sudden you're really kind of like writing these super dope articles and you're really getting work. And there are other writers and other journalists who aren't. And they're thinking, oh, he just knows the right people. You know, he just hangs out with the right people. Or, you know, he's just got the nice hair, or
and that's
or whatever the hell,
and that's what
you know what I'm talking about,
and that's what
like they thinking like okay, you
people
like
are saying that's what folks at home are saying to you that right. Like oh, you just got lucky.
Yeah, well, I just think that that's what happens in terms of, you know, comparison is the killer of joy. Wayne Dyer, I think that's the right quote. And in a world of comparison, especially right now with social media, everything is about comparing yourself to other people. You know, you'll get depressed just going through your Instagram feed on Christmas because your Christmas is not as popping as the Christmases that you're seeing across the world.
Sure.
Some of them all curated and fake and not real. You know, some people's lives are not even their lives, but it looks so fucking good on Instagram, you know? And, you know, all that to say is when that chip becomes the biggest crutch, because when you feel like, okay, now I can go back, and then you just realize that you should be doing this for you, that you had the right idea, you went for what your soul pushed you to, and it wasn't about coming to show someone, haha, you know, I made it. And that's why it's, you know, humility is probably the greatest aspect of, I feel, what I try to do in terms of my ideology of play like you're losing. Because when you walk up like, because it really wasn't you that got you there, it was the humility and that urgency. I have a journal, and I remember like when I was getting the opportunity to get the deal, because it was a development deal, and I got to do three songs. Those three songs were Till the Cows Come Knocking, Ascension, and Something Something. And they were reviewing whether those songs were going to be important for them to actually extend to me the opportunity to make an album. And I remember the day that I knew that that decision was going to be made, I remember just saying, if I get this, I promise I'll be so good. I promise I'll do everything right. And then it all happened. And, you know, fast forward, it got shelved. I was watching everyone be released, feeling like a complete loser, talking to Stuart Matthewman over like dinner and having him go, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. I promise you, it's a good record. Ascension's great. I mean, I know it's a weird title and they're telling you to change the title, but it's going to be okay. And then, you know, fast forward to today, sitting here in this kitchen, Mark Baptiste's home, and there's a guy outside in his car blasting a song that we wrote 23 years ago. And he's from here. You know, he's as local as it gets, and getting from the you know, the high rises in Manhattan, in the boardrooms, in the world, where a person who makes a decision about my music could never know what the person I just saw outside, what he goes through, what she goes through, that somehow it happened. And that's why, I don't know, that's where the humility comes in, because that's when you know, like, there was a destiny. And if I can say to anybody out there why they should do something, is it's in that faith of believing in that they're bigger players at hand than being with the right producer or writing with dating that person, or, you know, there are bigger forces at play. And if you attach yourself to those forces, then the ride can be so much better than you could have ever imagined it, you know?
That was so great. I learned a lot. And just listening to Max makes me feel inspired. I love his humility. I love his perspective. I love the way he says they're not cheering for him. They're cheering for the music. When you position it like that, I think it decreases the pressure on you and helps you get in a better position to shine. If you want to talk to me more about this or whatever, I'm on Twitter at Torre. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Chris Colbert in association with Cadence 13 Studios. We'll be back next week with more knowledge from successful folks because the man ain't shut us down yet. Check us out next Wednesday when my guest is the RZA, who goes deep on how to lead men.
Forced leadership doesn't work. So I wasn't like, I didn't force or impose myself like, yo, I'm the boss, I'm the leader. No, it was actually recognized that, you know, amongst my team, this is the man, this is the smartest dude right here. This is the dude that he's never broke his word. He would walk 10 miles to come get something for you. When a fight broke out, he never ran. If he saw you in another neighborhood and he was there and you had beef with the other dudes, he would join you in your beef. You know, the qualities of honor, I think, was in me. It's in me. And I think my brothers saw that.